Challenges and Temptation. Part 6. Destructive Abundance. Chapter 17. Leadership Lesson 1. So goes the culture, so goes the company. A culture sacrificed. Long-term greedy. These were the words Gustav Gus Levy, the venerable senior partner at Goldman Sachs, would use to describe the way the company operated. The year was 1970, and Goldman was a gentleman's organization, one that believed in partnership and doing what was best for the client and the firm. Given their reputation these days, it sounds funny, but Goldman bankers were known as the billionaire Boy Scouts for their seeming desire to always try to do the right thing for their clients. Long-term greedy meant that sometimes it was worth taking a short-term hit to help a client because the loyalty and trust it produced would, in time, pay back in spades. And pay back it did. Like so many organizations with a strong culture, Goldman Sachs grew while rivals struggled or failed. Starting in the 1970s and lasting until the early 1990s, it seemed Goldman could do no wrong. Up until the 1990s, their reputation was very high, writes Susan McGee, a journalist and author of the book Chasing Goldman Sachs. If an IPO was underwritten by Goldman Sachs, that was akin to the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. While we must be careful not to romanticize Goldman's culture, just as we must not romanticize the Greatest Generation, there is no question that it was considered the gold standard on Wall Street. And as with all strong cultures, it was hard to get in. By hard, I don't mean the academic standards. I mean something even more difficult. There was a time when even the most academically qualified candidates could not count on getting a position at Goldman. They had to be a good fit for the culture. They were expected to put the needs of the firm above their own. The partners had to sense that they could trust their people even more than their people could make them rich. The people, in turn, had to believe in long-term greed. It was because their culture was built on these high standards of character that Goldman did well in hard times. While other crews were busy trying to save themselves, sometimes even abandoning ship, Goldman's people came together to see their ship through rough waters. But something happened. Starting in the 1990s, and certainly accelerating after the company went public in 1999, there's evidence that the partnership culture started to break down. The time was ripe for a new mentality to take hold at Goldman. The regulations that had kept finance boring had all but disappeared by the time Goldman IPO was issued, wrote Harvard law professor Lawrence Lessig in a column for CNN.com. Bold and sometimes reckless experiments, financial innovations created incredible opportunities for firms like Goldman to profit, wrote Lessig. In this atmosphere, the quickly expanding firm began to embrace a new kind of trader, a decidedly more aggressive personality than the investment bankers who had previously occupied the firm's ranks. The standards by which new people were brought in now put academic pedigree and prior success before cultural fit. The arrival of the new broker caused resentment amongst those who were proud of the company they had built and the culture they devoted their lives to uphold and protect, and the company split into two distinct camps, the old Goldman and the new Goldman. One culture was built on loyalty and long-term greed, the other built on numbers and short-term targets. One was built on a balance of social chemicals, the other built on an imbalance that was tilted decidedly toward dopamine. The more people Goldman let in who were driven to maximize their own wealth and status, sometimes at the expense of the firm or the client's long-term advantage, the more damage it did to the culture of the company, its overall reputation, and ultimately the decisions the firm made. William Cohen highlights in his book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. The first time Goldman had actual layoffs, as in fired people because the firm was having a bad year, as opposed to for individual performance reasons, was in the early 1990s, and it was highly traumatic, Cohen writes. Think about that. Goldman Sachs did not embrace the concept of layoffs until the 1990s. Something had clearly changed. By 2010, with Goldman Sachs's role in the mortgage-backed securities crisis, coupled with the huge bonuses it gave out just months after receiving a government bailout, the company's tarnished reputation was at its lowest point. It was no longer the most trusted firm on Wall Street, but rather a symbol of its excess and greed. Its CEO, Lloyd Blankfein, even issued an apology. "We participated in things that were clearly wrong, and we have reasons to regret and apologize for," he said in November 2009. But it was too late, and half-hearted, many felt. No longer called the Boy Scouts, the Goldman Sachs leaders were considered something closer to crooks. This story is not unique to Goldman Sachs. I use Goldman to illustrate what is happening in a good too many of our companies across all sorts of industries. Every culture has its own history, traditions, languages, and symbols. When we identify with a culture, we articulate our belonging to that group and align ourselves with a shared set of values and beliefs. We may define ourselves, in part, by the culture of our country of citizenship, for example. I am an American. Or by the culture of an organization, such as I am a Marine. This doesn't mean we think about our cultural identity on a daily basis. But when we are away from the group, or if our tribe is threatened from the outside, it becomes more important. It can even become our primary focus. Remember how the country came together as one after the events of September 11th. In strong corporate cultures, employees will form similar attachments. They will identify with the company in a very personal way. The employees of WestJet, Canada's rebellious populist airline akin to America's Southwest Airlines, don't say they work for WestJet. That would make it a job. They call themselves WestJetters. It's an identity. When we don't have a sense of belonging, we wear a T-shirt stamped with the company logo to sleep in or while painting the house. When we have a sense of belonging, however, we wear the company swag in public with pride. When cultural standards shift from character, values, or beliefs to performance, numbers, and other impersonal dopamine-driven measurements, our behavior-driving chemicals fall out of balance, and our will to trust and cooperate dilutes. Like adding water to a glass of milk, eventually the culture becomes so watered down it loses all that makes it good and healthy. And by then, it only looks like or vaguely tastes like milk. We lose our sense of history, of responsibility to the past, and of shared values. We care less about belonging. In this kind of weak culture, we veer away from doing the right thing in favor of doing the thing that's right for me. To work for Goldman Sachs used to mean something more. It wasn't just a description of a place of employment. For those who fit the culture, it said something about what kind of person they were. It told the outside world what they could expect from them, and it was largely positive. A person could take pride in the association, but the leaders of the company didn't protect what took so long to build. As Goethe, the great 19th century thinker, reportedly summed up, "You can easily judge the character of a man by how he treats those who can do nothing for him." If character describes how an individual thinks and acts, then the culture of an organization describes the character of a group of people and how they think and act as a collective. A company of strong character will have a culture that promotes treating all people well, not just the ones who pay them or earn them money in the moment. In a culture of strong character, the people inside the company will feel protected by their leaders and feel that their colleagues have their backs. In a culture of weak character, the people will feel that any protection they have comes primarily from their own ability to manage the politics, promote their own successes, and watch their own backs, though some are lucky enough to have a colleague or two to help. Just as our character defines our value to our friends, so too does the culture of a company define its value to those who know it. Performance can go up and down. The strength of a culture is the only thing we can truly rely on. It's always fascinating to pay attention to the words people choose when describing their relationship with their jobs. Words like love and pride are feelings associated with oxytocin and serotonin, respectively, or in the case of Goldman Sachs, the lack thereof. "I don't feel safe," a current employee at Goldman Sachs told me. "I could lose my job at any moment. Goldman has no heart," she said. That she would say a company has no heart is a recognition of the lack of empathy in the culture. And when empathy is lacking, aggression, fear, and other destructive feelings and actions dominate. A former Goldman employee who worked at the firm in the 2000s, well into the cultural transformation, described an atmosphere of ruthlessness. with managers pitting one team of advisors against another as they fought for a project or client. He described an environment with no trust, no mutual respect, and above all, no accountability when things went wrong. The environment was one of win at all costs, even if it meant squashing a coworker, not to mention a client. Not surprisingly, despite the status one got from working at Goldman, a status probably built from the venerable years before, the former employee and nearly all his colleagues left for other companies within 2 years. It was just too much for a human to put up with if they wanted to maintain their sanity and be happy, if not successful. But the leaders allowed this culture to continue. On March 14, 2012, the New York Times carried an editorial by Greg Smith, then an executive director of Goldman Sachs, in which he announced his immediate resignation from the firm, where he had worked for 12 years. In it, he wrote about the firm's toxic culture. The culture was the secret sauce that made this place great and allowed us to earn our clients' trust for 143 years. It wasn't just about making money. This alone will not sustain a firm for so long. It had something to do with pride and a belief in the organization. I'm sad to say that I look around today and I see virtually no trace of the culture that made me love working for this firm for many years. I no longer have the pride or the belief. Leadership used to be about ideas, setting an example, and doing the right thing. Today, if you make enough money for the firm and are not currently an axe murderer, you will be promoted into a position of influence. When the history books are written about Goldman Sachs, they may reflect that the current chief executive officer, Lloyd C. Blankfein, and the president, Gary D. Cohn, lost hold of the firm's culture on their watch. When we assess how we feel about our jobs, we are often responding to the environments in which we work. It's not just about the work we're doing per se. And when a culture changes from a place where people love to work into a place where they go to work simply to take something for themselves, the finger gets pointed at the people who run the company. People will respond to the environment in which they operate. It is the leaders who decide what kind of environment they want to build. Will they build an inner circle around those closest to them, or will they extend the circle of safety to the outer edges of the organization? The vast majority of people who work at Goldman Sachs, despite what some critics would like to believe, are neither bad nor evil. However, the environment their leaders have created for them to work in makes it possible for them to do bad or evil things. As humans, our behavior is significantly influenced by the environments in which we work, for better and for worse. In November 2008, terrorists armed with automatic weapons attacked various sites in Mumbai, India, killing over 160 people. The Taj Mahal Palace Hotel was one of those sites. What makes the story of the Taj extraordinary, however, is that their employees risked their lives to save the guests. There are stories of telephone operators who, after having made it out safely, ran back into the hotel to call guests to help them get out. There are other stories of kitchen staff who formed a human shield to protect the guests as they tried to escape the carnage. Of the 31 people who died at the hotel that day, nearly half of them were staff members. Rohit Deshpande, a Harvard business professor who researched the events at the Taj, was told by senior management at the hotel that they couldn't explain why their people acted so bravely. But the reason is not elusive. It was the result of the culture those leaders had cultivated. One of the finest hotels in the world, the Taj insists that their people put the interests of their guests before those of the company. In fact, they are often rewarded for doing so. Unlike the culture of Goldman Sachs these days, at the Taj, grades and pedigree play less of a role in how they select their people. They've learned that graduates from second-tier business schools, for example, often treat others better than those from top-tier business schools. And so they prefer to hire from the second tier. Respect and empathy are valued over talent, skill, or motivation for personal advancement. Once hired, the staff's inclinations are reinforced and encouraged, which in turn builds a strong culture in which people can be trusted to improvise rather than do things by the book. The Taj knows its people will do the right thing, not the thing that's right for them. So goes the culture, so go the people. I'm always struck when a CEO of a large investment bank is shocked to learn that there was a rogue trader in their midst who, in pursuit of personal gains or glory, made decisions that caused damage to the rest of the company. What else should we expect from a culture that reinforces and rewards self-interested behavior? Under these conditions, a CEO is basically gambling that their people will do the right thing. But it's not the people who set the course, it's the leadership. Bad cultures breed bad leaders. Kim Stewart was just one of the many employees who suffered as a result of a toxic environment. She knew on her first day at Citigroup that there was something wrong with the culture. I remember I came home and I told my husband, I have to limit the number of smart things I say. The problem wasn't that she thought her boss or her colleagues were stupid, but rather that they felt threatened, a perfectly valid feeling to have in an organization with a weak circle of safety. There seemed to always be an air of suspicion and mistrust at the office. Stewart recalls that when she first joined the investment banking division in 2007, she immediately set out to understand the way the company closed certain kinds of deals. She went to her boss and asked him to confirm her understanding of the process, which he did. So why was her first deal an embarrassing disaster? Stewart later found out that her boss, concerned that her success might threaten his own status, intentionally left out a key part of the deal-making process, ensuring she would bomb. It was as if he wanted her to fail in order to make his performance look better. At Citi, Stewart says, the feeling was, I don't want anybody to know as much as I do, because then I'm expendable. This is a behavior designed for nothing but self-preservation. It is a classic symptom of a cortisol-rich, unsafe culture where valuable information is hidden to advance or protect an individual or small group, even though sharing would benefit the others in the group and the organization as a whole. Everybody feared being one-upped by a colleague, Stewart recalls. Nobody felt safe. And not because the company needed to make cutbacks. It was simply the culture. It would be another year before the company would suffer enormous financial losses, leading to its rescue by the federal government, in large part due to an atmosphere of hoarding information rather than sharing it. One cannot but wonder how the financial crisis would have turned out had more of the banks had healthier, chemically balanced cultures in which the people didn't feel threatened by each other. Of course, cutbacks did come eventually. In November 2008, the company had one of the single largest rounds of layoffs on record in any industry in history. On one day, Citi issued 52,000 pink slips, amounting to about 20% of its workforce. Stewart's department was cut by more than half, down from 190 to 95, and bonuses were slashed. Once the dust settled, you would think the leaders of the organization would have been humbled, but they weren't. Instead, the atmosphere got worse. Stewart recalls that in late 2011, a few years after the crisis, when the company was back in the black, her new boss at Citi, a managing director, arrived to introduce himself. He told the employees he was interested in only three things: revenue, net income, and expenses. Then he added privately to Stewart, "If you think I'm going to be your mentor and give you career advice, you're wrong." So goes the leadership. So goes the culture. A culture protected. Most people are familiar with post-it notes, but what most people do not know is how they came to be. Unlike so many companies that develop products by imagining and trying to build them, 3M owes the development of post-it notes and so many of its other products to one simple thing: its culture of sharing. Spencer Silver, the scientist who is partially credited with the creation of the post-it note, was working in his lab at the Minnesota-based company, actually trying to develop a very strong adhesive. Unfortunately, he wasn't successful. What he accidentally made was a very weak adhesive. Based on the job specs given to him, he had failed. But Silver didn't throw his failure in the trash out of embarrassment. He didn't keep his misstep a secret out of fear for his job, or guard it closely in the hopes of someday profiting from it. In fact, the unintentional invention was shared with others at the company, just in case someone else could figure out a way to use it. And that's exactly what happened. A few years later, Art Fry, another scientist at 3M, was in church choir practice, getting frustrated that he couldn't get his bookmark to stay in place. It kept falling off the page, off the music stand, and onto the floor. He remembered Silver's weak adhesive and realized he could use it to make the perfect bookmark. And that was the birth of what would become one of the best recognized brands in history, with 4,000 varieties sold in over 100 countries. Innovation at 3M is not simply the result of educational pedigree or technical expertise. Innovation is the result of a corporate culture of collaboration and sharing. In stark contrast to the mindset of the leaders at some investment banks, 3M knows that people do their best work when they work together, share their ideas, and comfortably borrow each other's work for their own projects. There's no notion of mine. In another company, Silver's botched formula might never have made its way into Fry's hands, but not at 3M. At 3M, we're a bunch of ideas, Fry is known to have said. We never throw an idea away because you never know when someone else will need it. The cross-pollination of ideas, combined with an emphasis on sharing across product lines, has led to an atmosphere of collaboration that makes 3M a place where employees feel valued. Innovation from interaction is one of the company's favorite mottos. Employees are encouraged to present new ideas at internal tech forums, regular gatherings of peers from other divisions. One sure sign that all this collaborating is working is that more than 80% of 3M's patents have more than one inventor. This kind of culture has nothing to do with the kind of industry 3M is in. Even an industry that is less collaborative by nature of its products or services can benefit from sharing. Huge improvements can happen just by getting a fresh set of eyes on the work. Hearing one person's solution to a problem can inform someone else how to solve a problem of their own. Isn't this the idea of learning? To pass on our knowledge to others? Take a look at the products 3M develops, and you will be amazed how their innovation leaps from one division to another. Scientists in a 3M lab developing products for the automotive industry set out to create a substance that would help auto body shops mix the filler they used to fix dents. The technology they used came from a 3M lab for creating dental products, from a substance dentists use to mix the putty for dental impressions. In another example, a 3M technology used to brighten highway signs would later be used to invent micro-needle patches, which allow injections to be delivered painlessly. The cross-pollination of ideas produces innovation to a degree that would make most people's heads spin. The company has over 20,000 patents, with over 500 awarded in 2012 alone. In 2009, in the middle of a very tough economy, when other companies were slashing their R&D budgets to save money, 3M still managed to release over 1,000 new products. 3M's products are ubiquitous, though typically unnoticed, and almost always taken for granted. If everyday products had a 3M inside sticker on them, like computers had an Intel inside sticker, the average consumer would see that sticker 60 to 70 times a day. 3M has succeeded not because they hired the best and the brightest, though I am sure they would argue that they do, but because they have a corporate culture that encourages and rewards people for helping each other and sharing everything they learn. Though 3M surely has its share of problems and bureaucracy, they work very hard to foster collaboration. Inside a circle of safety, when people trust and share their successes and failures, what they know and what they don't know, the result is innovation. It's just natural. Chapter 18. Leadership Lesson 2. So goes the leader, so goes the culture. I before you, me before we. He wanted to be in charge. He wanted to be the leader. And no one was going to stand in his way, not even the current leader. This is how Saddam Hussein came to power in Iraq. Even before he took power, he formed strategic alliances that would bolster his position and help ensure his own rise. And once in power, he showered his allies with wealth and position to keep them loyal. He claimed to be on the side of the people, but he wasn't. He was in it for himself, for the glory, fame, power, and fortune. And all his promises to serve were part of his strategy to take. The problem with such transitions is that they create a culture of mistrust and paranoia. Though things may be functional while the dictator is in power, once ousted, the whole country is left on shaky ground for years to come. These stories are not exclusive to the rise of dictators in unstable nations or plots of HBO series. All too often, similar scenarios play out in modern corporations. Stanley O'Neill's ascent at Merrill Lynch in 2001 is just one example. Born during the heart of the baby boom, in the small town of Wadawi in eastern Alabama, O'Neill, the grandson of a former slave, went to Harvard Business School on a scholarship from General Motors. He later took a job at GM and quickly rose through the ranks of the firm's treasury department. But he had his sights on other things, bigger things. And so, despite having no real interest or experience in the brokerage business, he moved on to Wall Street. One of only a handful of African Americans to make it to the top rungs of the banking industry, O'Neill had the opportunity to become one of the great leaders of our day, a symbol of what's possible in America. But he chose a different path. In 1986, he joined Merrill Lynch, and within a few years had become head of the junk bond division, which, ironically enough, would, under his leadership, become the biggest junk bond operator after Drexel Burnham Lambert's Michael Milken pleaded guilty to securities fraud in 1990. O'Neill later took over Merrill's huge brokerage division, eventually becoming the firm's CFO. When the internet bubble burst in the late 1990s, he quickly laid off thousands of employees, impressing his boss, then CEO David Kamansky, with his boldness, while cementing his growing reputation as a ruthless manager. In mid-2001, with Kamansky as his ally, O'Neill elbowed out several other contenders to become president of the company. But he wanted more. O'Neill wanted to do away with Merrill Lynch's employee-centric culture, something he saw as an obstacle. Affectionately known as Mother Merrill, a hint to the days when the culture was more balanced and human, Merrill Lynch was a great place to work. It was no secret, however, that O'Neill despised the culture, viewing it as soft and unfocused, something that got in his way. With no interest in fostering any particular healthy corporate culture, the business was all about competition, and a competitive atmosphere is, indeed, what he created. The culture he engineered was not one in which the people of Merrill simply competed furiously with outsiders. This was a culture in which people competed intensely against each other. Again, a leader always sets the tone inside an organization, and putting oneself before others was the tone O'Neill set. When 9/11 struck, Merrill was deeply affected, with hundreds of employees injured and three killed. Yet during the 12 months of emotional upheaval following the tragic event, like other Wall Street firms, O'Neill laid off thousands of employees and closed offices. Having marginalized his rivals by 2002, O'Neill's chess game was complete. The Merrill board forced his old friend Kamansky to retire early and made O'Neill chairman and CEO. With the gregarious Kamansky gone, the cultural transformation was nearly complete. Though not perfect, Kamansky would at least occasionally wander down to the employee cafeteria to eat with the others. O'Neill saw no value in that. He had no interest in fraternizing with his people. Instead, he used a private elevator to reach his office on the 32nd floor. Employees were also instructed not to speak to him in the halls and to stay out of his way if he passed by. Never one to let a good perk go to waste, on weekends, O'Neill would use the corporate jet to fly to his home on Martha's Vineyard. We work to advance the vision of a leader who inspires us, and we work to undermine a dictator who means to control us. And as the trust evaporated, it should come as no surprise that O'Neill's biggest threat, as in any dictatorship, would come from within. In a circle of safety, the people work to protect their leader as a natural response to the protection their leader offers them. This was not the case at O'Neill's Merrill, however. O'Neill's direct reports had begun working behind the scenes to put pressure on the Merrill board to undermine him. O'Neill caught wind and quickly squelched his opposition. It wouldn't take long for O'Neill to completely isolate himself at the top, allowing the culture of Merrill to be almost entirely driven by the intoxication of dopamine and the dread and paranoia of cortisol. The days of Mother Merrill were long gone. By this point, the attention of the firm's leadership was focused on creating the high-risk bonds that would help fuel the rise and collapse of the mortgage market. Is it any wonder the company was in no position to ward off the trouble that was about to befall it? In the summer of 2006, the investment chief, Jeff Kronthal, warned O'Neill of dangers ahead. Instead of working with Kronthal or implementing any safeguards for the good of the company, O'Neill fired him. O'Neill believed that if there was trouble ahead, only he could manage it, and so he tightened his grip to keep all the control. In October 2007, the company announced it had lost over $2.2 billion in the third quarter and written off $8.4 billion in failed investments. Finally, O'Neill's reign had come to an abrupt and inglorious end. He had successfully managed to isolate himself from his employees and his board, topped off by a decision to reach out to Wachovia about a possible merger without first discussing it with his directors. Any support he might have gotten was gone. How much was all that control worth? O'Neill left Merrill Lynch in disgrace with a severance package worth more than $160 million. I'm often amused by the irony of CEOs who believe in a pay-for-performance incentive model inside their companies, then expect huge payouts when they leave the company in shambles. Why do shareholders and boards not write into their contracts a prohibition against any severance if a CEO leaves the company in disgrace? Would that not at least be consistent and in the best interest of the company and its shareholders? But I digress. O'Neill represented an extreme version of the thinking that had taken over Wall Street, and in the end, it caused his downfall. He had isolated himself from the people he led, and making matters worse, he had so successfully fostered internal competition that, not surprisingly, those who had once been on his team turned against him. As I have already shown, the problem is not how a company conducts its business per se. The problem lies with the quality of relationships within the organization, starting with the leader. The more attention a leader focuses on their own wealth or power, the more they stop acting like a leader and start taking on more of the attributes of a tyrant. Mark Bowden wrote a remarkable piece about Saddam Hussein in the Atlantic Monthly. In it, he describes how the tyrant leader exists only to preserve his wealth and power. And this is the problem. Power, as Bowden further explains, gradually shuts the tyrant off from the world. And as we already know, when distance is created, abstraction settles in, and soon after comes the paranoia. The tyrant sees the world against them, which only compels them to shut out even more people. They set up more and more rigid controls around their inner circle, and as their isolation increases, the organization suffers. Absent any care from above, those inside the organization are less likely to cooperate. Instead, competing against each other becomes the best way to advance. And when that happens, the success individuals in the group may enjoy will not be met with congratulations from others, but with jealousy. If a leader were purely evil, or if we believed there was no chance to enter their inner circle, then the seeds of rebellion would form. But when the possibility exists that we might make it in, or if, on the other hand, we're unsure whether we will be thrown to the wolves, we become almost immobilized. It is the rustle in the grass, the fear of what may be lurking, that initiates the flow of cortisol into our bloodstreams. It is the cortisol that makes us as paranoid and focused on self-preservation as the isolated leader above. This is what O'Neill did at Merrill. He changed the culture from one that offered certainty of protection to one of uncertainty. And, as in Iraq, there was no solid foundation left for the company to sustain itself. There just wasn't enough trust to go around. O'Neill's rise and fall is not just a story of how one man's ambition can bring down a company. In the end, everyone and everything suffers in these conditions. All that control, focused at the top, can lead to only one outcome: eventual collapse. True power. David Marquet was a career submariner. Graduating near the top of his class from the Naval Academy, he's a pretty smart guy. In fact, it's partly because of his smarts that he climbed his way up the ranks of the U.S. Navy. Knowing the right answers, he was able to give good instructions and issue good orders. He was the leader because he was in control. At least, that's what he'd been taught. The Navy, like many organizations, rewards smart, goal-oriented people with recognition and promotion. And so, Captain Marquet was recognized and promoted. He worked his way up to earn one of the great honors any naval officer could earn, his own command. He was to be captain of the USS Olympia, a nuclear-powered Los Angeles-class fast attack submarine. The Navy has boomers, huge submarines that carry unlaunched nuclear missiles. The smaller, nimbler, fast attack subs are designed to hunt down the other guy's boomers and, if it came to it, destroy them before they had a chance to launch their missiles. An elaborate game of cat and mouse played across the expanse of the globe's oceans, and Captain Marquet was now a key player in the game. To prepare for the big job, Captain Marquet spent a year studying Olympia's systems and crew. And in typical Marquet fashion, he worked hard to learn as much as he could. He learned every wire, every pipe, every switch the Olympia had. He pored through the personnel files to get to know everything he could about his crew. Like many people in charge, he felt he needed to know as much, if not more, than his crew to be a credible leader. Given the importance and honor of his new position, this time was not going to be an exception. Less than 2 weeks before Captain Marquet was scheduled to take command of the Olympia, he got an unexpected call from the powers that be. There was a change in plans. He would not be captaining the Olympia after all. Instead, he was assigned to take command of the USS Santa Fe, a slightly newer Los Angeles-class submarine. But there was one other little detail. The crew of the Santa Fe ranked last in nearly every readiness and retention measurement the Navy had. While the Olympia was considered the best of the best, the Santa Fe was at the bottom, the bad news bears of nuclear subs. But Captain Marquet was a smart guy and saw the change as a challenge. Like many a senior executive with a strong ego and a big brain, he saw himself as the one who could take charge and turn this ship around. If he gave good orders, he would have a good ship. And if he gave great orders, he would have a great ship. At least that was his plan. And so, on January 8, 1999, Captain Marquet stepped off the dock at Pearl Harbor and onto the $2 billion, slightly longer than a football field vessel, that 135 crew members would now call home. As one of the newest ships in the fleet, the Santa Fe had a good deal of equipment that was different from what Captain Marquet had trained up on for the Olympia. For someone used to being in control, to being in a situation they don't fully understand, they can often be blind to their own ignorance. Or worse, they may choose to hide what they don't know for fear of having others question their authority. Even though he knew he'd have to rely on his crew more to fill the gaps in his knowledge, Captain Marquet kept that fact to himself. His technical knowledge was the basis for his leadership authority, and with that gone, he, like many leaders, worried he would lose the respect of his crew. As it turns out, old habits die hard. Instead of asking questions to help him learn, Captain Marquet defaulted to what he knew best, being in control, and started issuing orders. And it seemed to work. Everything seemed to go smoothly. The crew jumped to his words, an aye-aye here and an aye-aye there. There was no question who was the boss. The serotonin flowed through Captain Marquet's veins, and it felt good. The next day, while out at sea, Captain Marquet decided to run a drill. He had the nuclear reactor manually shut down to simulate a reactor failure. He wanted to see how his crew would react if faced with the real thing. And for a while, everything seemed to go well. The crew performed all necessary checks and precautions and switched to running the submarine on battery-powered motor, or EPM. Though not nearly as powerful as the nuclear reactor, the EPM could keep the submarine running at slow speeds. But the captain wanted to push his crew further, to see how they would do with a little more pressure. He gave the officer of the deck, the ship's navigator and most experienced officer on board, a simple instruction: ahead two-thirds. This meant that he wanted the crew to run the electric motors at two-thirds of their maximum power. It would drive the ship faster, but it would also run the batteries down more quickly, which would add a sense of urgency to get the reactor up and running again. The officer of the deck acknowledged the captain and repeated the order out loud, instructing the submarine's driver to turn up the speed. "Ahead two-thirds," he said to the helmsman. And nothing happened. The submarine's speed remained the same. Captain Marquet peered out from behind the periscope to look at the junior enlisted crew member who should have executed the order. The young sailor, sitting at the controls, was squirming in his seat. "Helmsman," Captain Marquet called out, "what's the problem?" To which the young sailor replied, "Sir, there is no two-thirds setting." Unlike every other submarine Captain Marquet had ever been on, the newer Santa Fe didn't have a two-thirds setting on the battery-powered motor. Captain Marquet turned to the navigator, who'd been aboard for over 2 years, and asked him if he knew there was no two-thirds setting. "Yes, sir," replied the officer. Dumbfounded, Captain Marquet asked him, "Then why did you issue the order?" "Because you told me to," said the officer. It was at that point that Captain Marquet was forced to face the reality of the situation. His crew had been trained to follow instructions, and he had been trained for another submarine. And if everyone was going to blindly follow his orders simply because he was in charge, then something very, very bad could happen. What happens when the leader is wrong in a top-down culture? Everyone goes off a cliff, Captain Marquet would later write. If he was going to succeed, he would have to learn to trust his bottom-ranked crew more than he trusted himself. He had no choice. A nuclear-powered submarine is not like a company. In a company, we think that when things go wrong, we can simply replace our staff or change technology to make it work better. It's an option that a good too many leaders of companies think is an advantage. It also assumes that the right people are being let go and the right people are being hired. But what if we're forced to run our companies like Captain Marquet had to run his submarine? He couldn't return to shore and ask for a better crew and a more familiar ship. This is the challenge that Marquet now faced. As much as he knew and as smart as he was, everything he thought he knew about leadership was wrong. He couldn't have his crew blindly follow his orders anymore. The consequences could be devastating. Now he needed everyone to think, not just do. Those at the top, explains Captain Marquet, have all the authority and none of the information. Those at the bottom, he continues, have all the information and none of the authority. Not until those without information relinquish their control can an organization run better, smoother, and faster and reach its maximum potential. The problem, Captain Marquet says, was that he was addicted to being in control. And the crew, like in so many organizations that follow a flawed interpretation of hierarchy, were trained for compliance. In organizations in which few take responsibility for their own actions, at some point, something bad is going to happen, something bad that was probably highly preventable. One can't help but think again about the companies that suffer thanks to the decisions of a few selfishly minded people within their organizations. Whether these individuals act unethically, commit a crime, or simply work counter to the interests of the organization, neither they nor their leaders seem to take responsibility. Instead, they point fingers. Republicans blame Democrats, and Democrats blame Republicans when things don't get done. Mortgage companies blamed the banks, and banks blamed the mortgage companies for the 2008 financial meltdown. Let us be grateful that none of them are responsible for the care of nuclear-powered submarines. Captain Marquet came to understand that the role of the leader is not to bark commands and be completely accountable for the success or failure of the mission. It is the leader's job instead to take responsibility for the success of each member of his crew. It is the leader's job to ensure that they are well trained and feel confident to perform their duties, to give them responsibility and hold them accountable to advance the mission. If the captain provides direction and protection, the crew will do what needs to be done to advance the mission. In his book, Turn the Ship Around, Captain Marquet goes through all the specific steps that he took, that any organization can take, to develop an environment in which those who know more, the people who are actually doing the work, are empowered to make decisions. One of the things Captain Marquet did was change the culture of permission to a culture of intent. He literally banned the words, permission to, aboard the Santa Fe. Sir, request permission to submerge the ship. Permission granted. Aye, aye, sir, submerging the ship. This standard way of operating was replaced with simply, sir, I intend to submerge the ship. The chain of command remained intact. The only difference was a psychological shift. The person performing the action now owned the action instead of carrying out an assigned task. When pushed just how far he took this I intend idea, Captain Marquet is quick to point out that there are only three things he can't delegate. I can't delegate my legal responsibilities, I can't delegate my relationships, and I can't delegate my knowledge. Everything else, however, I can ask others to take responsibility for, he says. What is so remarkable about this model, and what is so important about these three responsibilities, is that though they cannot be handed off, they can all be shared. And that's what the best leaders do. They share what they know, ask knowledgeable people for help performing their duties, and make introductions to create new relationships within their networks. Poor leaders hoard these things, falsely believing it is their intelligence, rank, or relationships that make them valuable. It's not. In an organization with a strong circle of safety, not only is the leader willing to share knowledge, but so too is everyone else. Again, the leader sets the tone. When our leaders reveal their gaps in knowledge and missteps, not only are we more willing to help, but we too are more willing to share when we make mistakes, when things go wrong. Inside the circle, mistakes are not something to be feared. In organizations in which there is no safety provided, people are more likely to hide mistakes or problems out of self-preservation. The issue is, those mistakes and problems, if not addressed, often add up and appear later when they become too big to contain. This is what Captain Marquet was forced to learn. Only when confronted with a failed model, when he reached a point of failure or despair, or realized that the people acting under these conditions could never be expected to do their best work, did his entire focus and effort change course. Captain Marquet resisted acting on his instinct to take control. Now he took great delight in giving it away and seeing others rise to the responsibility they were given. The relationships aboard the submarine strengthened, and the overall culture of trust and cooperation dramatically improved. They improved so much, in fact, that under his leadership, the crew of the Santa Fe, once the lowest rated in the entire U.S. submarine fleet, became the best rated crew in Navy history. The goal of a leader is to give no orders, Captain Marquet explains. Leaders are to provide direction and intent and allow others to figure out what to do and how to get there. This is the challenge most organizations face. We train people to comply, not to think, Captain Marquet goes on. If people only comply, we can't expect people to take responsibility for their actions. The chain of command is for orders, not information. Responsibility is not doing as we're told. That's obedience. Responsibility is doing what is right. Captain Marquet did more than take his ship from worst to first. That in itself was a finite accomplishment and of no significant value to the long-term success of the organization he served. That's like making the quarter or the year but ignoring the decade. Captain Marquet created an environment in which the chemicals that incentivize behavior were more balanced. The systems he put in place aboard the Santa Fe rewarded trust and cooperation, and not just obedience and achievement. As the crew's oxytocin and serotonin levels increased, so did their pride and their concern for each other and the success of the ship. And with the social chemicals flowing, they also became much better at solving problems together. Unlike the people in Stanley O'Neill's Merrill Lynch, the crew of the Santa Fe went from waiting to be told what to do and working to protect their own hides to sacrificing for each other and working for the good of the whole. They didn't try to undermine their captain. They wanted to make him proud, and everyone benefited. The re-enlistment rate went from only 3 the year before Captain Marquet took command to 33. The Navy's average is 15 to 20. On average, about 2 to 3 officers per submarine will get selected for their own command. In contrast, 9 out of the 14 officers aboard the Santa Fe went on to command their own ships. The Santa Fe didn't just make progress, it made leaders. In physics, the definition of power is the transfer of energy. We measure the power of a light bulb in watts. The higher the wattage, the more electricity is transferred into light and heat, and the more powerful the light bulb. Organizations and their leaders operate exactly the same way. The more energy is transferred from the top of the organization to those who are actually doing the job, those who know more about what's going on a daily basis, the more powerful the organization, and the more powerful the leader. Chapter 19, Leadership Lesson 3, Integrity Matters. The Foxhole Test. The colonel apologized for being a few minutes late for the meeting. He was dealing with an incident, as he called it. An imposing figure, he was every bit a Marine. Posture as straight as a 2x4, broad shoulders, slim waist, his uniform perfectly pressed and worn with pride. His head held high, he oozed confidence. As the officer in charge of the Marine Corps Officer Candidate School, or OCS, in Quantico, Virginia, he took his responsibility very seriously. Though technically a school designed to train the officer corps, OCS, the Marines will tell you, is more of an officer selection process. It's hard to get thrown out of boot camp, basic training for enlisted Marines. But if someone doesn't meet the standards to be a leader of Marines at OCS, then they won't become an officer. Simply wanting to be a leader and being willing to work hard is not enough. Unlike in the private sector, where being good at doing is often rewarded with the position of leading, in the Marines, leadership is also a matter of character, not just strength, intelligence, or achievement. On this particular day, something had happened with one of the officer candidates that warranted the attention of the colonel. In fact, it was so serious that they were considering throwing the candidate out of OCS altogether. My curiosity bubbling, I asked what the candidate had done that could potentially end his career as an officer in the Marine Corps. It must have been pretty serious. I wondered what crime he had committed. "He fell asleep on watch," said the colonel. "That's it?" I asked. "You guys are stricter than I thought." "This guy fell asleep. He wasn't in combat. He didn't put any lives at risk. He fell asleep in the woods of Virginia." "And that's enough to end his career?" I thought to myself. "It has nothing to do with his falling asleep," said the colonel. When we asked him about it, he denied it. When we asked him about it again, he denied it again. Only when we showed him irrefutable proof did he say, "I'd like to take responsibility for my actions." "The problem we have," said the colonel, "is that taking responsibility for one's actions must happen at the time you perform your actions, not at the time you get caught." He went on to explain that in the Marine Corps, trust and integrity are considered matters of life and death. If this would-be leader were put in charge of a platoon of Marines, and those Marines could not completely trust that the information their officer was giving them was the truth, good, bad, or indifferent, then the Marines might hesitate, question the officer's decisions, or fail to pull together as a team. And when that happens, when we cannot trust the very people who are supposed to be responsible for us, bad things occur. In the case of the Marines, this means people could die. If Marines told to obey their officer suspect for a second that that officer would avoid the truth or not take responsibility for their actions simply to cover their own tail or make themselves look better, then the circle of safety shrinks and the entire fabric and efficacy of the group of Marines decays. The Marines are as good as they are, not simply because they are big, strong, and fearless. They are also good at what they do because they trust each other and believe, without a doubt, that the Marine to the left of them and the Marine to the right of them, regardless of rank, will do what needs to be done. This is the reason Marines are so effective as a group. The same is true in every organization, even ones in which the decisions are not a matter of life and death. When we suspect the leaders of a company are saying things to make themselves or the company look better than they are, or to avoid humiliation or accountability, our trust in them falters. This is a natural response. Our brain interprets the information we receive with our survival in mind. If we suspect our leaders are bending the truth to favor their own interests, then our subconscious mind prefers we don't climb into a foxhole with them. Another Marine also fell asleep during the same exercise at OCS. He owned up to it immediately and was given an appropriate punishment. From a leadership perspective, the Marines have no problem with him. He made a mistake, and that's fine. He was honest and took responsibility for his actions immediately. Leadership, the Marines understand, is not about being right all the time. Leadership is not a rank worn on a collar. It is a responsibility that hinges almost entirely on character. Leadership is about integrity, honesty, and accountability, all components of trust. Leadership comes from telling us not what we want to hear, but rather what we need to hear. To be a true leader, to engender deep trust and loyalty, starts with telling the truth. How not to build trust. Integrity, said the CEO, is the bedrock of our foundation. According to Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, integrity means a firm adherence to a code of especially moral or artistic values. This means that operating with integrity is sometimes a higher standard than operating within the confines of the law. Incorruptibility is the word offered as a synonym. Integrity is more than a word written on a wall with all the other company values. It is the reason we trust one another, the bedrock of trust, to use the CEO's choice of words. We need to know that the information given to us by others, and especially our leaders, good or bad, is the truth. We need to know that when someone says something, they mean it. If we doubt their integrity, then we cannot trust them with our lives or the lives of those we love. If we doubt someone's integrity, we would hesitate before jumping into a foxhole with them. The integrity of those in our community is, as our brain perceives it, a matter of life and death. As humans, as social animals, we are hardwired to constantly assess the information people give us and the actions they perform. It is a constant and ongoing process. We do not trust someone after they tell us just one thing, even if it is the truth. Trust evolves once we have enough evidence to satisfy our brain that a person or an organization is indeed an honest broker. This is the reason integrity, for it to work, must be a practice and not simply a state of mind. Integrity is when our words and our deeds are consistent with our intentions. A lack of integrity is at best hypocrisy and at worst lying. The most common display of a lack of integrity in the business world is when the leader of an organization says what others want to hear and not the truth. This is the reason we don't trust politicians. Though we may sit down with a list of statements a politician has made and agree with every single one of them, the reason we tend not to trust them is because we suspect that they don't believe all the things they are saying. We don't even agree with everything our close friends and family say or believe, so it stands to reason that if a politician is in perfect alignment with us, that they are not being completely honest. Politicians spend time on the road shaking hands and learning about us when they are campaigning. But if they really cared about us, then they would spend time shaking hands and meeting us all year round, and not just when it suited their agenda. Ron Paul, a 2012 presidential candidate, held opinions that were not popular with the country. Yet he was much more trustworthy than almost all the other candidates because he was willing to express those opinions, knowing full well that they would not get him elected. Moreover, those opinions were consistent with things he said in the past. I do not agree with Ron Paul on many issues and would not vote for him. Yet, I would be more likely to trust him in a foxhole than I would some of the people I do vote for. All for one reason. He has integrity. Integrity is not about being honest when we agree with each other. It is also about being honest when we disagree, or even more important, when we make mistakes or missteps. Again, our need to build trusting relationships as our social brain sees things is a matter of life and death, or in the case of our modern Western lives, a matter of feeling safe, secure, and protected versus feeling isolated and vulnerable. We need people to admit when they falter and not try to hide it or spin the story in an attempt to protect their image. Any attempt at spin is self-serving, and such a selfish motivation can do damage to our group should danger present itself. This is not a complex idea. For leaders, integrity is particularly important. We need to trust that the direction they choose is in fact a direction that is good for all of us and not just good for them. As members of a tribe, who want to feel like we belong and earn the protection and support of the group, we will often follow our leaders blindly with the belief or hope that it is in our interest to do so. This is the deal we make with our leaders. We in the group will work hard to see their vision become a reality, and they will offer us protection along the way, which includes honest assessments and commentary. We need to feel they actually care about us. It's just like that CEO said. Integrity is the bedrock of our foundation. Michael Duke, the Chief Executive Officer, President, Director, and Chairman of the Global Compensation Committee, and Chairman of the Executive Committee of Walmart. Yes, that's his full title, told shareholders. Our culture is who we are. It isn't just words written on the wall at the home office or stapled to the bulletin board in the back room of the store, he went on. It sets us apart from the competition, and it appeals to people everywhere. So wherever we go and whatever changes we make, we must keep our culture strong. I truly believe that the retailer that respects individuals, that puts customers first, that strives for excellence, that is trusted, will win the future. I admire leaders who believe in the value of culture. I respect leaders who put people first. And I have deep loyalty to those who believe integrity is the bedrock of an organization. These beliefs are the makings of a very strong culture, one in which the people are committed to one another and to the organization. A people-first attitude and a commitment to integrity are at the core of the United States Marine Corps culture, and they drive decisions at Barry Waymiller, even if they don't issue press releases that say so. How are we to feel, then, when Duke says at the same shareholders' meeting, where he talked about integrity, that his number one priority is growth? I thought it was customers. Does that mean that culture, defined as the aggregate of the common values and beliefs of a group of people, is just a list of things written on the wall? According to Walmart's 2011 proxy statement, Duke made $18.1 million that year. What the proxy statement doesn't reveal is that the company had changed the manner in which Duke's bonus was calculated. For many years, the CEO's bonus was based on same-store sales, but the board that Duke chairs changed the criterion to overall sales, an easier goal to hit. It turns out that the same-store sales had been in decline for 2 years, which would have hurt Duke's compensation. With the rule change, his performance evaluation could take advantage of overall revenues, a number heavily buoyed by Walmart International. Jackie Goebel, a Walmart employee from Kenosha, Wisconsin, like Duke, is given an annual bonus based on company performance. In 2007, her bonus, which was based on same-store sales, was more than $1,100. But unlike Duke's, her bonus structure was not changed, and as a result, in the same year Duke earned $18.1 million, Ms. Goebel was given $41.18. The rules were changed not to benefit everyone in the organization, just the guy at the top. Despite the fact that the priorities Mike Duke and the board expressed to one group do not appear to be the priorities they expressed to another group, and even though they seem to act in a manner completely opposite to the definition of integrity, it is not entirely their fault. The problem is that they only learned about the impact their decisions have on others from reading numbers on spreadsheets. This is one of the side effects of destructive abundance. When operating at such scale, how can they possibly be expected to extend the circle of safety beyond themselves and other senior executives, the people they actually know? When our leaders operate under such conditions of abstraction, they will naturally work to prioritize their own interests over those of others. Inner circles take precedence over wider circles of safety. Not only that, but an example is set for the rest of the company as well. When leaders take steps to protect their own interests, particularly when those steps are taken at the expense of others, they send a message to everyone else that it's okay to do the same. This is where Duke can and should be held accountable for the decisions that call his integrity into question. The leaders of companies set the tone and direction for the people. Hypocrites, liars, and self-interested leaders create cultures filled with hypocrites, liars, and self-interested employees. The leaders of companies who tell the truth, in contrast, will create a culture of people who tell the truth. It's not rocket science. We follow the leader. Between 2005 and 2009, the general manager of Ralph Lauren's Argentinian subsidiary, along with some of his employees, had been regularly paying bribes to government officials in exchange for fast-tracking shipments and allowing the company to skirt import regulations. The employees made the bribes through a customs broker and even went so far as to create fake invoices to cover their tracks. They created fake labels to disguise the payments, describing them as loading and delivery expenses, taxes, and the like. For more than 4 years, the company's employees in Argentina had plied customs officials with gifts, including cash, jewelry, expensive dresses, and even a handbag that retails for more than $10,000. Violating any number of laws that govern international trade, upon learning about the crimes, the leaders of Ralph Lauren Corporation sounded the alarm. They could have tried to cover it up, or at least have hired an expensive public relations company to put an elaborately crafted spin on the story, attempting to shield the company from any possible fallout. But instead, within days of learning about the bribes, Ralph Lauren executives contacted U.S. authorities to explain what they had found and to offer further assistance in the federal investigation of their own business dealings. By the time officials in the parent company caught on, the bribes had reached a total of nearly $600,000. In the end, Ralph Lauren Corporation was forced to pay penalties and fees of about $882,000 to the Justice Department and $732,000 to the Securities Exchange Commission. But the trade-off was worth it. Like the Marine who took responsibility for falling asleep and accepted his punishment, Ralph Lauren showed it could be trusted, and all its leaders had to do was tell the truth. The penalties may have cost the company $1.6 million, but had they not been honest, it would have cost the company their reputation and the trust they have built up with all those who work with them. Profit wasn't worth violating their integrity. Building trust requires nothing more than telling the truth. That's it. No complicated formula. For some reason, too many people or leaders of organizations fail to tell the truth or opt to spin something to appear that they did nothing wrong. Again, our primitive brain, evaluating everything in terms of survival, can see through that. This is why we so often don't trust politicians or big corporations. It has nothing to do with politics or big business, per se. It has to do with the way that politicians and the leaders of corporations choose to talk to us. Every single one of us should look at our managers or the leaders of the companies we work for and ask ourselves, would I want to be in a foxhole with you? And the managers and the leaders of the companies who rely on our hard work should in turn ask themselves, how strong is our company if the answer is no? A corporate lesson in telling the truth. Responding to backlash over a plan to charge customers $5 per month to use their debit cards to make purchases, Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan proclaimed that the company had the right to make a profit. But such statements did little to quell the outrage felt by Bank of America customers across the country, who rallied together and vowed to close their accounts with the bank in protest. There were demonstrations in Los Angeles and Boston, and a woman in Washington collected 300,000 signatures in a show of solidarity against the North Carolina company. Further fueling the anger was the realization that this fee would not apply to all Bank of America account holders. The most affluent would be exempt. It was primarily average checking account customers, many of whom lived paycheck to paycheck, that would be affected. Bank of America leaders refused to divulge whether the number of account closings was higher than average following the announcement of their new policy. But on Tuesday, November 1st, 2011, exactly 33 days after the announcement, the bank issued a press release stating that they had decided to drop the plan. The leaders of large companies change their minds about decisions they make all the time. We expect that both people and companies will make mistakes and dumb choices. We're perfectly at peace with that. Making all the right decisions is not what engenders trust between people or between people and organizations. Being honest does. And being honest is exactly what Bank of America did not do when they decided to squash the idea of adding the fee. Bank of America first discussed the fee idea exclusively within business circles. And at the time, they were very clear and direct about their motivations and intentions. They, among other banks, were very vocal in their opposition to the Dodd-Frank Act, which put limits on how banks could charge fees following the financial crisis. The economics of offering a debit card have changed with recent regulations, a Bank of America spokeswoman said. It was widely reported and undisputed what these new fees were designed to do, to make up for the shortfall. Many banks were considering them. Bank of America was just the first to pull the trigger. The company said one thing to the financial community, but another to the public. When they formally revealed the plan, they actually had the audacity to say that the proposed fees were designed to, quote, help customers take full advantage of all the additional features like fraud protection. It's not even a good spin. That's like General Motors telling us that they're going to charge us $5 for every day we drive so that we can enjoy all the amazing features of their new car. But Bank of America customers didn't buy it. And so, in the face of public outrage, the bank changed their story. In a terse, four-sentence press release, they attempted to undo the damage they had done to themselves. Charlotte, North Carolina, November 1st, 2011, Business Wire. Bank of America will not implement debit usage fee. In response to customers' feedback and the changing competitive marketplace, Bank of America no longer intends to implement a debit usage fee. We have listened to our customers very closely over the last few weeks and recognize their concern for our proposed debit usage fee, said David Darnell, co-chief operating officer. Our customers' voices are most important to us. As a result, we are not currently charging the fee and will not be moving forward with any additional plans to do so. As a quick aside, quote, listening to customers usually happens before decisions are made and not after, but let us not trifle with such things. The reality is, what the bank's executives were actually listening to were the sounds of TV anchors chastising, picketers shouting outside their offices, and the money leaving their own accounts as customers reportedly closed theirs at uncomfortably higher than average levels. The only thing that Bank of America needed to do to build trust with their customers, and indeed with Wall Street, was to tell the truth. That's all. What if the press release announcing the reversal of their decision had sounded more like this? Charlotte, North Carolina, November 1st, 2011. Bank of America did not expect such a backlash. In response to customers' outcry and such a negative reaction in the press, Bank of America no longer intends to implement a debit usage fee. "We're facing bigger economic challenges than we're used to," said David Darnell, co-chief operating officer. "In an effort to boost our revenues, we thought we would try to implement a fee on debit card purchases. We expected some backlash, but not as much as we got. As a result, we will not be moving forward with any plans to charge any additional fees on debit card purchases for any of our customers. Further, we apologize for being short-sighted. We've certainly learned an important lesson about just how valuable our customers are and how much influence they can have over our financial standing." Even though their decision would still have been completely counter to customer interests, simply being honest about it would have done more to engender trust. Bank of America actually would have enhanced their reputation had they simply told the truth. The trust we have for an organization is built the same way as the trust we have for individuals. We need to know what to expect so we can better navigate our social bonds and know with whom we can make ourselves vulnerable and with whom we can express our weaknesses or turn our backs. It's not about winning or losing. All we want to know is if we can feel safe in a foxhole with you. Like the Marine who wanted to take responsibility for his actions only after he got caught, there is a disturbing trend in modern business to do the same. When a company gets caught with its hand in the cookie jar, do the leaders have a meeting to discuss how to mitigate or avoid punishment, or do they discuss the need to do the right thing based on a higher moral code, a code of ethics and integrity? Unlike the leaders of Ralph Lauren, the leaders of Bank of America chose to spin information to give the appearance of concern for their customers, when as plain as day, they were acting out of more concern for themselves. Say your boss tells you that the company you work for has suddenly lost its biggest account, and that as a result, you and everybody else in your department are going to have to take a pay cut, perhaps even a furlough as the company tries to regroup. "Sure, it's going to be tough for a while," your boss says, "but if you agree to stay on, you'll be compensated once things improve." Whom would you more likely believe with this information? An executive from Bank of America or an executive from the Ralph Lauren Corporation? As the Zen Buddhist saying goes, how you do anything is how you do everything. Chapter 20. Leadership Lesson 4. Friends Matter. To win or to serve. At some point in the early 1990s, Newt Gingrich, Republican representative from Georgia's 6th Congressional District, frustrated that the Democratic Party had control of the House for decades, decided it was time to give the Republicans a shot at power and take the majority. The trouble was, he was tinkering with a system that wasn't really broken. The two parties actually worked quite well together. Though the Democrats had the majority in Congress, unlike today, the primary goal wasn't to brag about who had control. It was to brag about who got things done. Knowing that whoever had the majority still needed the other party, the Democrats didn't take full credit every time something was accomplished. Efforts were made behind the scenes to allow both parties to claim victories and appeal to their respective bases. Election after election, the Democrats kept the majority by default, not because they were better per se. When control was not the primary goal, things got accomplished and both parties were able to get their needs met by working together. It was also common practice at the time for members of Congress, once elected, to move their families to Washington, D.C., returning to their home district offices as often as the congressional schedule permitted. In Washington, they existed in a small world in which their families went to the same churches and schools, regardless of their party affiliations. Democrats and Republicans would argue, debate, and criticize each other in committee by day, and then attend the same school events, backyard barbecues, and cocktail parties at night. Despite their differences, relationships formed, as did the ability to trust and cooperate with each other. Charles Gibson, former news anchor and fellow at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, recounts how George McGovern, Democratic senator from South Dakota, and Bob Dole, Republican senator from Kansas, would both take to the floor of the Senate and rail against each other's policies, then be seen behaving as the best of friends later the same day. In another example, Tip O'Neill, the outspoken Democratic Speaker of the House, had regular meetings with Republican leader Bob Michael. They worked together. As Reagan's tax cuts were being debated in the early 1980s, Gibson recalls that O'Neill told Congress, "The president has no concern, no regard, no care for the little man in the country." In response, President Reagan accused O'Neill of sheer demagoguery. Later, when the president called O'Neill to smooth the waters, O'Neill is said to have replied, "Old buddy, that's politics. After 6 o'clock we can be friends, but before six, it's politics." These days, the politics seem to last all day and all night, leaving little time for the friendships. And so it was. Members of opposite parties bridged the gap by forging friendships that gave them perspective. They felt a sense of common purpose. Though divisions had always existed in Washington, for most of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, Congress functioned. Democrats and Republicans had, for the most part, figured out how to cooperate, which, as our biology and anthropology help us understand, happens most effectively when we physically work together and get to know each other. Gingrich, a man who seemed more obsessed with winning than anything else, would set Congress on a new course, however. Cooperation was out. The new goal was control. The strategy he chose was to tear apart the existing system. To disrupt the status quo, he worked to portray a system so corrupt that only a complete overhaul could save it. And in 1994, he succeeded. The Republican Party took control of the House with Gingrich at the helm as Speaker. And the hope for any cooperation between parties was over. Once in charge, Gingrich promoted a whole range of changes that completely altered the way things were done in Washington. And it started with more fundraising. One of the changes included the idea that House members should spend the majority of their time in their home districts, not in the Capitol. In the 1980s, nearly two-thirds of members of Congress lived in Washington, D.C. Today, you'd be hard-pressed to find more than a handful. Instead, members fly into Washington for a short work week, arriving at Congress on Tuesday and returning to their home states on Thursday evening. The result marks a major shift in relations between Democrats and Republicans. Spending most of the week away from where the work is in order to fundraise, members of the two parties now even have less opportunity to talk to each other, and they certainly don't socialize together as routinely as previous generations of legislators. And with that, there is little opportunity to develop trust. Of course, there were many forces at play that led to the deeply divided Congress we have today, and Gingrich's ascendancy was just one of them. Redistricting and highly politicized media programming contribute to the polarization, as has over-reliance on the internet. Why work face-to-face in Washington when you can send an email from anywhere? Members of Congress have gone from sharing power to hoarding it. With no single guiding vision or purpose, we've moved from governing as a selfless pursuit to governing for selfish gain. Just as business moved from serving the customer to serving the shareholder, Congress went from a culture of cooperation to a battle of wills. All leaders, in order to truly lead, need to walk the halls and spend time with the people they serve. Eyeball leadership, as the Marines call it. The same goes for our elected officials. Yet that's not what's happening. Today, members of Congress say they're spending more time in their home districts in order to better serve their constituents. But they don't actually serve them by doing this. There's little evidence that when back in their home states, our elected representatives are visiting factories or working with citizens to better understand their needs, except perhaps during an election season. What they seem to be doing more of when they return home is fundraising to help ensure their re-election. When we are disconnected from the people with whom we work, We spend more time focused on our own needs than the needs of the people for whom we're supposed to be responsible. In a PowerPoint presentation shown to newly elected Democratic members of Congress, the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, recommends a model schedule while members are in Washington. 4 hours spent making fundraising calls, 1 to 2 hours for constituent visits, 2 hours for work on the floor or in committee, 1 hour for strategic outreach, breakfast, meet and greets, and the press, and 1 hour for recharge time. In fact, Tom Perriello, who served in Congress for one term, told the Huffington Post that the 4 hours allocated to fundraising may even be lowballing the figure so as not to scare the new members too much. Regardless of whether or not the members uphold the model schedule, it is just another example of the pressure to make the numbers, win elections, and stay in power instead of building relationships, finding common ground, and making progress for the common welfare. Like the CEO of a public company who cares more about winning and numbers than they do about the people who are doing the actual work, so too have our elected officials got their priorities backward. It is not a surprise that the relationships in Congress today are in a shambles. Hostilities between the parties are at an all-time high. Veteran congressmen recount anecdotally that in the past, about 80% of the debate about a new bill would happen behind closed doors in committee, and 20% on the floor for the camera. These days, party leadership takes debates to the floor before attempting to get consensus in committee first. Olympia Snow, the Republican senator from Maine who served for 33 years, decided in 2012 not to stand for re-election, even though she was the easy favorite to win. In a statement given by Snow and reported by one of her hometown papers, she explained, "I have had to consider how productive an additional term would be. Unfortunately, I do not realistically expect the partisanship of recent years in the Senate to change over the short term. So at this stage of my tenure in public service, I have concluded that I am not prepared to commit myself to an additional 6 years in the Senate." Snow is just one of a growing number of people who, after devoting their lives to public service, are now leaving due to frustration with the caustic environment. If the good guys are leaving, that means that the future of our government is in the hands of the ones who either benefit from the current system or have the stomach to endure the excessive fundraising, increasing short-sightedness, and growing culture of self before service. The result of such an aggressive atmosphere in our government is, as we would expect, a lack of trust and progress. A Gallup poll in January 2013 showed that the U.S. Congress had an approval rating among Americans of only 14%. That's lower than the approval rating of used car salesmen or even Genghis Khan, the 12th century Mongolian emperor infamous for his slaughter of as many as 40 million people, most of them innocent civilians. It is not surprising that 3/4 of Americans, the poll shows, believe that the way politics works in Washington is harmful to the country. And based on all we know about the conditions necessary for trust, cooperation, and progress to exist, they'd be right. If, as social animals, we are most productive when we trust and cooperate, then a lack of trust and cooperation means less will get done. Congress is now considered largely ineffective as a governing body. At the time this book was written, the 112th Congress, the Congress that served from January 3, 2011 until January 3, 2013, was considered the most polarized Congress in history. It passed fewer laws than any time since the 1940s, only 220. The Congress before that passed 383 bills into law, and the Congress before that passed 460. If we accept that passing laws is a legitimate metric of cooperation, even the Congress that previously held the record of least productive, the 104th Congress from 1995 to 1996, was more cooperative with the 333 bills they passed into law, over 100 more than the 112th. The disregard for the human element of governing shows a steady downward trend in the ability of Congress to get anything done, and the effects of this are dramatic. According to political observers, the public largely blames the inability of members of Congress to work together for the economic crisis of 2008. A polarized Congress has been blamed for a lack of progress on the deficit, on reforming Social Security, and on dealing with climate change, among a host of other things. Some current members blame the system, or the speed with which news is able to spread in a wired world, for their struggles and low approval ratings. However, they ignore the fact that they are the system, and the internet doesn't do them harm, it simply reports on the harm they do. The problem is not politics, money, or the media. They are symptoms of the problem. The reason our Congress is as ineffective as it is just a matter of biology. The members of Congress don't spend any time together. If they don't get to know each other and the people they represent, the flow of the social chemicals is limited, and the drive to raise money and win elections makes dopamine their primary incentive. The environment in which our legislators now work makes it difficult for them to trust each other or work together for the benefit of anyone but themselves. Enemies fight, friends cooperate. The members of Congress from the House Agriculture Committee were in Romania as part of a tour to learn more about trade policy and meet some of their European counterparts. It was only by chance that Bob Goodlatte, the long-serving Republican congressman from Virginia, and Stephanie Herseth Sandlin, a junior Democratic congresswoman from South Dakota, found themselves the only two people from the delegation with nothing to do after a day of meetings. And so, they decided to do some souvenir shopping together. Despite serving on the same committee, the two representatives served different parties, and by the unwritten rules of Congress, that meant they were adversaries. Until that day, their relationship could have been described as cordial at best. There is something about getting together out of context that makes us more open to getting to know someone. Whether we're bonding with colleagues with whom we play on the company softball team, out to lunch or on a business trip with someone we don't know well, when the responsibilities of our jobs are not forcing us to work together, when our competing interests are put aside for a while, we seem to be quite open to seeing others as people rather than co-workers or competitors. This may be one of the reasons peace talks so often happen in serene environments where the two warring parties can go for a walk together. And that's exactly what happened with Representative Herseth Sandlin and Representative Goodlatte. Without the weight of politics or their respective parties breathing down their necks, the two of them went exploring together. The Democrat and the Republican became Steph and Bob. And as it turned out, they really hit it off. Though they disagreed on many things at work, they had a lot in common as regular people. As we all know, it is the things we have in common with people that attract us to each other and are the basis of friendship. By the modern standard, what happened between the two members of Congress with opposing views is almost unheard of. Given how little time members spend in Washington, there is simply less opportunity to get together socially with people they like, let alone to try to form relationships with people they're expected to resent. But on this day in Romania, the seeds of friendship would be planted and later grow into something that would serve both representatives for years to come. With the foundation laid, Representative Herseth Sandlin and Representative Goodlatte continued to get together for meals in Washington with no other reason than they enjoyed each other's company. They started to see and treat each other as human beings instead of adversaries. Like any two warring parties that eventually make peace, the two representatives learned that what they had in common was the basis of the trust they needed to talk about the things about which they disagreed. "We paid attention to each other," Herseth Sandlin recounted. "We listened to each other, and we compromised on bills we might not have otherwise." Goodlatte and Herseth Sandlin still voted in opposition to each other more often than not. They didn't always see eye to eye on legislation, but they didn't need to. It was because of mutual respect and friendship that occasions arose when they agreed to do the right thing, even if it meant one of them would have to vote against the party line, which, unlike in a parliamentary system, is technically what we elect our representatives to do in America. Representative Goodlatte even voted for an amendment sponsored by Herseth Sandlin, much to the disappointment of GOP leadership, she said. That rarely happens these days. It's worth noting that when Olympia Snowe voted to allow more debate on the subject of health care reform, her own party lambasted her publicly and threatened to pull her funding just because she voted to continue to talk about it. Cooperation doesn't mean agreement. It means working together to advance the greater good, to serve those who rely on our protection, not to rack up wins to serve the party or ourselves. What the two members of Congress built was a genuine appreciation and respect for each other. What they formed was nothing more than what we in the world outside of politics would call a friendship. That such a relationship should be considered extraordinary enough to serve as fodder for a book is somewhat disturbing. Getting to know the people with whom we work every day seems like it should be the normal way of doing things. A few years before Goodlatte and Herseth Sandlin's experiment, a few forward-thinking members of Congress tried to do the same thing. Recognizing the caustic, relationship-lacking environment that consumes Washington politics, they called for a series of retreats with the aim of encouraging greater civility in Congress. The first one was held in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and Dr. William Urey, world-renowned peace negotiator and co-author of the book Getting to Yes, was there. He recalls several representatives telling him the same thing about the quality of the relationships in Congress. They had spent more time with members of the other party during those 3 days than they had in their entire careers, Urey recounted. Sadly, the retreats were soon canceled due to lack of interest. It turns out that friendship and trust can't be built over 3 days. It takes a regular commitment of, no big surprise here, time and energy. If there is conflict, without knowing each other, it's very hard to make peace, says Urey. And Urey knows a thing or two about peace. Founder of the Harvard Negotiation Project, he is widely seen as one of the leading authorities on negotiating. He is often called upon to help negotiate peace deals among adversaries in various parts of the world. We need them to understand each other, he says, to humanize each other, and to listen to each other. Few would argue with Urey's sentiments. We know that for there to be peace between Israel and Palestine, the leaders must meet. They must talk. We know that for there to be peace between India and Pakistan, they must be willing to come to the table and to talk and to listen. And when the parties refuse to talk, refuse to listen, refuse to even meet, then the odds are high that the conflict will only continue. How can our Congress have the credibility to tell the world how to make peace when they seem incapable of demonstrating how it's done? Herseth Sandlin and Goodlatte are a model of what could be. If the system will not allow for one party to socialize with the other party, hope lies with the individual senators and representatives who have the courage to lead. If they are driven by the desire to serve their constituents and the country, then investing time and energy simply to get to know each other is essential. If, however, they are driven primarily by the desire to win elections and keep their party in power, then the current system is working just fine. For them, not for anyone else. Without retreats or formal engagements, all that is required is for a few progress-minded members in one party to personally reach out to a few progress-minded members of the other party to meet for a drink or a bite to eat with no agenda. If they care about the American people, it is anthropologically necessary for them to get together for no other reason than to get to know each other. Like any relationship, some will get along and some won't. But in time, cooperation will happen. Chapter 21. Leadership Lesson 5. Lead the people, not the numbers. Neutron Jack. 10 years after economist Milton Friedman wrote about the social responsibility of business, to use its resources and engage in activities designed to increase its profits so long as it stays within the rules of the game, his words became the rallying cry of a new movement that would consume Wall Street and corporate America. The primacy of the customer was replaced with that of the shareholder, the true owner of the company, a self-serving definition that is often refuted by legal experts. The thinking was that by focusing on shareholder value, companies would build wealth, create jobs, and fuel the economy. Everybody wins. But that's not what happened. By everybody, they meant only a few. When we understand the history of the theory of shareholder value, the results aren't surprising. The 1940s saw the rise of managerialism, a system that defined U.S. corporations as having a broad social purpose. For most of the 20th century, the directors of large public corporations saw themselves as trustees and stewards, charged with steering institutions in directions that served the public as they provided stable, lifelong jobs. It was a system that worked fairly well until the challenges of the 1970s. In January 1973, the U.S. stock market reached past a peak before entering a two-year period of almost steady decline fueled by a number of events. It started with President Richard Nixon's decision to abandon the gold standard, which led to inflation, among other challenges, followed by the Arab oil embargo in 1973, during which time the price of oil quadrupled. Add the impact of Watergate and the war in Vietnam, and the U.S. economy stagnated. The market wouldn't hit bottom until December 1974, 4 months after Nixon's resignation, when the Dow Jones reached a low of 577, a 45% drop from its high less than 2 years earlier. It was the beginning of a new era in which companies' share price had little to do with its overall performance. As humans do when facing uncertainty and confusion, people went looking for answers. Corporate directors and stakeholders were eager to protect their interests and return to growth, and economists sought a simple metric for measuring corporate performance. They found it in a little-known theory called shareholder value. Though Milton Friedman first proposed the general idea, it was a pair of academics, William Meckling of the University of Rochester and Michael Jensen of the Harvard Business School, who spread it with a piece they published in the Journal of Financial Economics in 1976. It was the answer everyone was looking for, a formula that could solve the problems of a corporate America fed up with stagnation and falling profits. In 2012, Professor Lynn Stout of Cornell Law School wrote a definitive work on the subject, The Shareholder Value Myth, in which she points out that shareholder value was instantly appealing to two influential groups, activist corporate raiders and company CEOs, the very groups that would stand to benefit most from it. And so it took hold. Carl Icahn and other corporate raiders began trolling for financially stricken companies to swallow, and there were a lot of them in those days. They typically went looking for companies whose stock was undervalued, bought up shares, and then forced the board to cut expenses, usually through layoffs or by selling parts of the company. At the same time, the pay of corporate executives became directly linked to stock performance in the form of options and bonuses, thereby ensuring that executives were financially incentivized to put their priorities ahead of both customers and employees. During the boom years of the 1980s and 1990s, titans like Jack Welch, then CEO of General Electric, and Roberto Goizetta, who ran Coca-Cola, were pioneers in building companies to maximize shareholder value. And for a time, it seemed to work. That is, for shareholders. Both companies made their shareholders and their executives a lot of money. Back in the managerialist period, CEOs were typically paid in fat salaries and small bonuses, while in this new period, they would be paid according to stock price. The strategy gave rise to the first generation of billionaire CEOs who neither founded the company nor took it public. Goizetta, in fact, holds the distinction of being the first American business executive to become a billionaire on the basis of stock holdings in a company he didn't found or take public. The second was Microsoft's former CEO, Steve Ballmer. By the end of the 1980s, shareholder value had become a managing principle at GE, where Welch had been in charge since 1981. Every year, Welch would fire the bottom 10% of his GE managers, those whose divisions contributed the least to the company's share price, while rewarding the top 20% with stock options. This rank-and-yank system was in place for most of Welch's tenure at GE and helped earn him the derogatory nickname Neutron Jack. Welch did indeed succeed at building a powerful company that made lots of money for its shareholders, and many companies still consider the Welch way the route to higher profits. While he was running things, GE sales increased from $26.8 billion to $130 billion. The company's market cap rose 30 times, making it the most valuable company in the world by the time of his departure. There's no question what Welch achieved was remarkable, and that few others have achieved anything near it. However, if we compare GE's performance to the performance of the S&P 500 over the same time period, it makes the accomplishment seem less impressive. GE's trajectory matched the trajectory of the market for the time that Welch was in power. It's like celebrating the rise of an oil company's stock as the price of oil increases. A rising tide lifts all ships. This is a point not lost on Welch's successor, Jeffrey Immelt, who took over when Welch left in 2001, right before things got really rough. Anybody could run a business in the 1990s, Immelt told the Financial Times in 2009. A dog could have run a business. It is also worth pointing out that during this period, half of GE's profits came not from its core industrial business, but from its financial arm, GE Capital. If we judge Welch by the kind of leadership that succeeds by focusing on profit before people, then he retains his title as Wall Street's hero, a man brilliant at developing systems to maximize short-term value. But great companies and great leaders are the ones able to succeed beyond any one leader and manage through hard times. What if we judge a leader not on what they do when they are holding the torch, but on what happens after they pass it on? On that metric, Welch doesn't fare as well. A leader's legacy is only as strong as the foundation they leave behind that allows others to continue to advance the organization in their name. Legacy is not the memory of better times when the old leader was there. That's not legacy, that's nostalgia. The founding fathers of the United States have a strong legacy because the United States was built to last long beyond their lifetime. GE was built to maximize the opportunity of the day, a day when the numbers mattered more than the people. It was not an opportunity built to last, and so it didn't. Jim Collins and Jerry Porras make the case in their book Built to Last, that when the genius at the top leaves, they take all their expertise and genius with them. In contrast, when a leader has the humility to distribute power across the organization, the strength of the company becomes less dependent on one person and is thus better able to survive. In this model, instead of trying to command and control everything, the leaders devote all their energy to training, building, and protecting their people, to managing the circle of safety, so that the people can command and control any situation themselves. That's the best way to protect the legacy of the leader and extend the success of the company for many years after the leader departs. According to a study conducted by Dr. Natalia Lorenkova, who studies management and leadership at Wayne State University, teams led by a directive leader initially outperform those led by an empowering leader. However, despite lower early performance, teams led by an empowering leader experience higher performance improvement over time because of higher levels of team learning, coordination, empowerment, and mental model development. In other words, all of the benefits of higher performing teams are direct results of feeling safe among their own and believing that their leaders have their well-being at heart. Any other model is simply a gamble that the next genius will be as good as the one who left, irrespective of how strong the rest of the company could be. This gamble on the next guy theory adds an unbalanced importance and uncomfortably high risk to succession planning. If the new leader can't command and control as effectively as their predecessor did, it is doubtful many inside the organization will put themselves at risk to advance the leader's vision. They'll be too busy trying to protect themselves from each other. At some companies, layoffs continue to be such a normal occurrence in the fourth and first quarters, when the company is trying to make their numbers, that some employees take extreme measures to protect themselves. A source at a large investment bank, privy to this information, told me that like clockwork, during the period before the announcement of annual earnings, the number of internal complaints filed for harassment, discrimination, and whistleblowing protection suspiciously go up. There is no obvious reason why there would be a season for complaints. One would expect an even distribution throughout the year. And there is no reason why harassment, discrimination, and whistleblowing protection should all happen at the same time. It turns out that the number of internal complaints goes up right at the time when some companies start looking at their end-of-year numbers and making preparations for layoffs to meet their projections. It seems that at the end of the year, employees start filing complaints in an attempt to protect their bonuses and, at the same time, their jobs. It's not a culture that inspires people to give their blood, sweat, and tears to the company, its leaders, or each other. It's a culture of watching your own back. And so they do. Welch and others, through the 1980s, pioneered using people as an expendable resource to the benefit of investors. Since then, it has become increasingly more common for companies to use layoffs to beef up their bottom line. It is considered an acceptable business practice today to lay off people, often ending their careers, simply to balance the books for the quarter or the year. If careers are to be ended, it should be for negligence or incompetence, or at least as a last resort to save the company. But in our 21st century version of capitalism, the expectation that we are working in meritocracies seems false. In many cases, it doesn't matter how hard we've worked. If the company falls a little short, people will have to be laid off. No hard feelings. It's just business. Can you imagine getting rid of one of your children because you made less money than you expected last year? Imagine how your kids would feel if that were the plan. Well, that's how it is in too many companies today. By the mid-1990s, the transformation was complete. Shareholder primacy was now the mantra of corporate America, and with it came a whole host of new problems. Thanks to cultures with unbalanced levels of dopamine-driving behavior and too much cortisol flowing, empathy had become limited and self-interest a dominant motivation. And with that, we started to see an increase in stock manipulation, massive pay inequality, and more than a fair share of accounting fraud, all of which continue to this day. It seems reasonable that the leaders of companies should work hard to protect the interests of the company's owners. However, a strong case can be made that shareholders don't actually own the companies. In the view of Professor Stout, Friedman, the hero of modern capitalist economics, was simply wrong. There is no legal standing to the idea that shareholders are the true owners of corporations. They simply own shares, which are abstract representations. In legalese, corporations own themselves. And given that shareholders are not the true owners of corporations, corporations have no legal requirement to maximize share price, as many have claimed. Professor Stout takes this thinking even further, to argue that maximizing shareholder value has failed. Sure, it's fat in the pocket of the corporate elite, but in virtually every other way, it has been bad for business and bad for the companies themselves. Employees are forced to work in atmospheres where short-term performance is valued above all else, and where the well-being of people is almost always put second, the consequences of which are empirically bad for the company. And contrary to its claim, shareholder value maximization has done little or nothing for dispersed shareholders. According to research conducted by Roger Martin, the dean of the Rotman School of Management, shareholders who invested in the S&P 500 in the years prior to 1976 enjoyed real compound average annual returns of 7.5%. After 1976, the average dropped to 6.5%, he says, and has been even lower than that since 2000. There's a growing body of evidence that the companies that are the most successful at maximizing shareholder value over time are those that aim toward goals other than maximizing shareholder value, Justin Fox and Jay Lorsch wrote in the July-August 2012 issue of the Harvard Business Review. Employees and customers often know more about and have more long-term commitment to a company than shareholders do. Consider the case of British Petroleum. As examples go, I'll concede it is an extreme one, but it highlights what happens when people ignore the impact of their behavior on others. Boom and bust. On the night of April 20th, 2010, the shareholders' value exploded into the news, quite literally. This was the day an explosion aboard the Deepwater Horizon oil rig killed 11 workers and caused 5 million barrels of sticky, black crude oil to start spewing into the Gulf of Mexico, creating an environmental and financial disaster that would take far longer to fix than the 5 months it took to cap the well. How could a catastrophe of such epic proportions happen? Accidents are a normal outcome of human carelessness or mistakes, and we all make mistakes. But that so many would later call the accident inevitable means this was more than an isolated error. As it turns out, BP had a long practice of cutting corners in safety in order to stay on schedule and on budget. After an explosion in 2005 at BP's Texas City refinery killed 15, the company reluctantly admitted it had ignored safety procedures to keep costs down. During the 3 years prior to the Deepwater explosion, BP had racked up 760 egregious, willful safety violations, according to OSHA records. Over the same period, Sunoco and ConocoPhillips had each racked up 8, while Exxon had only one comparable citation. A survey of workers in the deepwater, all of them whom either worked for BP or Transocean, the rig's owner, taken just weeks before the blast, showed there was an overall feeling among the workers that the deepwater rig was entirely unsafe. The data was there in front of the owners, but they wouldn't listen. Blinded by their own dopamine-driven focus, they were simply too short-sighted to heed the warnings. By the spring of 2005, the Deepwater Horizon project was already more than 6 weeks behind schedule and $58 million over budget. The pressure on the company was intense. Each additional day's delay was costing another $1 million. Eventually, BP would plead guilty to 11 felony counts, in addition to which it faced more than 1 million claims filed by aggrieved parties. BP has already paid $713 million in lost tax revenues to Louisiana, Alabama, Florida, and Texas. The company estimates the cost of the overall settlements at $7.8 billion, on top of the $17.6 billion fine imposed for environmental violations. Based on the fines alone, BP could have been 12 years behind schedule and still have lost less money than it has over the oil spill. As Professor Stout points out, BP would have done much better for its shareholders even if it had delayed well development for as long as a year in order to follow proper safety measures. Shares of BP were $59.88 in the week preceding the spill. On June 21st, as the spill entered its third month, shares were $27.02. Nearly 3 years later, in February 2013, the shares had still not recovered, trading at about $40 a share. The shareholder, invested in multiple companies and industries, not only lost money if they had any holdings in BP, but the impact of BP's carelessness was felt throughout the industry. A ban on drilling in the Gulf, combined with the longer process for obtaining offshore oil and natural gas permits, were estimated to cost the United States more than $24 billion in lost oil and natural gas investment, according to industry officials. The same report, commissioned by the American petroleum industry, estimated that the United States lost 72,000 jobs in 2010 and 90,000 jobs in 2011 as a result of the spill. Add to that, if any shareholder, as part of their well-balanced portfolios, owned any property in the Gulf region, or equity in companies that operated in any businesses affected by tourism, including restaurants, construction, shipping, and a host of other industries, their finances were harmed as well. If providing the shareholder the value they expected was BP's chief goal, it's a wonder why the loudest voices against BP, the ones demanding greater controls, weren't the oil companies themselves. The rise of shareholder primacy and an over-reliance on external dopamine incentives to drive that primacy has put executives in the habit of thinking for the short term, a trend that is not surprising if you consider that the average tenure of a corporate CEO is 5 years. Consider GE. Like many of the powerful financial companies of the 1980s and 1990s, it was not built for hard times. Nor was Enron, nor was WorldCom, nor was Tyco. These companies had something else in common as well. They all had hero CEOs who maximized shareholder value for the short term and managed the lives of human beings like they were numbers on a spreadsheet. But numbers never save anyone in hard times. People do. Even Welch himself would eventually call the focus on shareholder value the dumbest idea in the world, insisting to this day that he always saw shareholder value as an outcome and not a strategy. The emphasis businesses put on shareholder value was misplaced, he said. Your main constituencies are your employees, your customers, and your products, he goes on to say. A few days after Welch spoke these words in 2009, 8 years after his retirement, GE lost its AAA credit rating with Standard & Poor's, toppling it from its perch as one of the nation's most creditworthy companies. The perverse interpretation of shareholder first has created cultures in which barely a single person working in any public company, large or small, feels protected by their leaders. Too many CEOs seem to skip the hard work of actually leading their employees. With an eye on short-term results, executives can't truly inspire workers. Wall Street's priorities maintain unreasonable power over executives, and, by extension, entire company cultures. People in these companies fear they could lose their job if the stock takes a tumble. And to our primitive human brain, that feeling initiates instincts of survival. When fight or flight is the name of the game, and no broad circle of safety exists, then kill or get fired is the best strategy. Feeling uncertain and insecure, our ability to create relationships and trust in a scalable or meaningful way is near impossible. And when that happens, our work suffers, the culture suffers, and the whole organization suffers. But not so fast. It is also important to note that we, the shareholders, are also just as susceptible to the lure of profits over people. During the dot-com bubble, we were the ones investing based on tips from our friends. Research was something largely ignored. With dopamine driving our need for instant wealth, we lunged at opportunities without taking the time to check all the facts. Worse, fearing we would miss out, we seemed to blindly trust information regardless of the source. We cannot get away with simply pointing a finger at people like Welch or BP, or the theory of shareholder value when we behaved just as irresponsibly to make a quick buck. Leadership by the people. The performance of a company is closely tied to the personality and values of the person at the top, and the personality and values of the person at the top set the tone of the culture. A man who has penned 5 books about leadership and put his own face on the cover of all of them, Welch, it's fair to say, liked his celebrity, and the culture of his company followed. In Jack Welch's GE, people were pitted against each other. They were driven to do whatever they could do to make themselves look good. A priority was put on the thrills of dopamine achievement, capped off with a selfish love of serotonin-fueled status. Being number one was all that mattered. Ooey-gooey oxytocin be damned. James Senegal is different. He ran his company completely the opposite of how Jack Welch ran his. Most people don't even know who Senegal is. He doesn't put his own face on things, and he would rather his people get the credit instead of him. The co-founder of Costco, Senegal ran the company from 1983 until his retirement in January 2012. Unlike Welch, Senegal believed in a balanced culture, one in which looking after people was the priority. Senegal knew that if the company treated their employees like family, their employees would reciprocate with trust and loyalty. He rejected the widely held notion that to succeed in retail, particularly in the warehouse sector, companies need to keep salaries low and employee benefits at a minimum. His people-first attitude was the foundation of a culture that allows the social chemicals to operate as they were intended, and this, in turn, allows trust and cooperation to develop. Workers are praised for finding solutions and better ways of doing things. They look out for each other rather than competing against each other. Both Senegal and his successor, Craig Jelinek, have taken heat from more than a few Wall Street analysts for this approach. Back in 2005, when Senegal refused to pass on a greater percentage of healthcare costs to employees, Emmy Kozloff, an analyst at Sanford C. Bernstein & Company, faulted him for being too benevolent, a description I suspect Senegal quietly appreciated. Ignoring less than selfless counsel from those outside the company is one of the factors that make CEOs like Senegal leaders and not followers. It should come as no surprise at this point that the empathy leaders like Senegal have for their employees is, in fact, good for business. If you had invested in GE and Costco in January of 1986, just after Costco went public and only a few years into Welch's tenure as CEO of GE, at the time this book was written in October 2013, you would have made about 600% on your investment in GE, about the same as the S&P average. In the same period, you would have made nearly 1,200% investing in Costco. Though GE's highs reached levels of 1,600% on the initial investment, it was a roller coaster to get there, and there was no guarantee you would have timed the sale just right before the decline. However, in Costco, you would have enjoyed a comparatively steady, even-keeled ride, even through the rough waters of a difficult economy. This further confirms Dr. Lauren Kova's research that distributing power, though not as good in the short term, is much better over time. Good leadership is like exercise. We do not see any improvement to our bodies with day-to-day comparisons. In fact, if we only compare the way our bodies look on a given day to how they looked the previous day, we would think our efforts have been wasted. It's only when we compare pictures of ourselves over a period of weeks or months that we can see a stark difference. The impact of leadership is also best judged over time. Unlike Welch, Senegal, by cultivating a strong circle of safety, built his company for bad times as well as good ones. He also built it to survive him, which is why Costco's profits continue to grow even through Senegal's retirement. Certainly, Costco saw its growth slow during hard economic times. Its share price suffered through the last half of 2008, and not every store has been a success. But a look at the big picture reveals a stability not found in companies whose leadership is ruled by the thrills of dopamine. Performance can and does boost morale in the short term, but, as is the case with all dopamine rewards, that feeling doesn't last. In contrast, when a balance of serotonin and oxytocin is maintained and the focus is put on morale first, performance will follow and the strong feelings will last. When people feel good about working at the company, they will work harder for the company, in that order. Costco has succeeded because it recognizes employees are like family, not in spite of the fact. That Costco is an amazing place to work actually drives the company's performance. In other words, what's good for employees really is good for Costco's shareholders. Today, Costco is the second largest retailer in the country and the seventh largest in the world, and it shows no signs of slowing down. Wall Street is in the business of making money between now and next Tuesday, Senegal once said. We're in the business of building an organization, an institution that we hope will be here 50 years from now. Even through the recession that started in 2008, the company posted profits of more than $1 billion a year, while continuing to have the highest wages in the retail business and providing company-subsidized health insurance to nearly 90% of its employees. Costco pays its workers an average of about $20 an hour, while the federal minimum wage is only $7.25 an hour. By comparison, Walmart's average wage for full-time employees in the U.S. is roughly $13 an hour, and the company provides health care insurance for only about half of its workers. And that's not all. While Walmart and other major retailers have rallied behind an effort to defeat an increase in the federal minimum wage, Costco executives have been vocal in their support of it. Instead of minimizing wages, said Jelinek in a 2013 statement supporting an increase, we know it's a lot more profitable in the long term to minimize employee turnover and maximize employee productivity, commitment, and loyalty. The leaders of Costco believe every company should extend the circle of safety to every employee, including the ones at the lowest levels of the organization. In the fall of 2009, the slowdown of the economy began to hit the retail sector hard, and Costco, like its competitors, began to feel the pressure. In April 2009, the company reported a 27% decline in sales. The industry began to retract, and some chains announced layoffs. What did Senegal do? He approved a $1.50 an hour wage increase spread out over 3 years. According to Costco CFO Richard Galanti, Senegal was steadfast in his insistence that workers needed extra help during a recession, not the opposite. This economy is bad, Senegal is reported to have told Galanti. We should be figuring out how to give them more, not less. That's not to say Costco has never had layoffs. It has. In early 2010, 160 employees out of 450 in a brand new store in East Harlem, New York, received pink slips after the store's sales were disappointing. The difference between Costco and companies like Welch's GE is that Costco uses layoffs as a last resort, whereas the GEs of the world use them as routine strategy. As a result of this attitude, turnover at Costco is extraordinarily low, less than 10% for hourly employees. Whereas people go to work for Walmart because they want a job, people go to work at Costco because they want a future and a sense of belonging to a team. The company also prefers to promote its longtime employees to executive positions rather than hire from outside, and almost never goes looking for business school graduates for managers. According to Bloomberg Businessweek, more than two-thirds of Costco's warehouse managers started as cashiers and the like. This is one of the protections the leaders of Costco have embraced to ensure that the circle of safety they have spent so long building stays intact, that those who benefit from it will stick around and keep it strong. This is the value of loyalty. Customers will never love a company until the employees love it first. Only when a critical mass of employees feel like their leaders are working to help defend them from dangers outside can the company then invite customers into the circle too. It's usually the people at the edges, the infantry, so to speak, who are the most vulnerable to the external dangers. They are also the ones who tend to have more contact with the clients and customers. If they feel protected, then they will do all they can to serve the customers without fear of repercussions from the company's leaders. It is a given that profit is a goal of any business, but to suggest that it is the primary responsibility of a business is misguided. It is the leaders of the companies that see profit as fuel for their cultures that will outlast their dopamine-addicted, cortisol-soaked competitors.